Hello and welcome to episode 1-8 of the Cough and Crate Bar, a PC gaming podcast serving only rum and lemsip this week in our fictional pub. I'm Marsh Davis and I'm joined this evening by Tom Francis.
Hello.
And Chris Thurston.
Hello.
Who, despite being very poorly, despite having been given the illness that I had last week,
thanks,
is decided to struggle on like a brave soldier that he is.
Thank you very much. It means a lot to have your support at this difficult time.
And illness.
And illness.
And talking of being a brave soldier, returning to the war in an awkward segue. What's your news this week?
Well, half an hour ago at the time that we record this, obviously, Overwatch beta has returned to much screaming and crying from people.
Was that expected?
Yes, they announced... No, it wasn't a surprise. They didn't announce the date, but they said it would relaunch with the progression system that game would have, that they'd have stripped out apparently prior to the last beta without showing anybody what it was, kind of restored to the game. Because obviously Overwatch, since the point where it was sort of first revealed or even first playable, and then up to BlizzCon and afterwards, had a lot of questions around it, sort of how you would pay for it, what you would pay for. Most people assumed it would be free to play because it was a character-centric online competitive game. And then they announced at BlizzCon that it would be a full-boxed game with no like purchasing characters or whatever. And so this today's thing, it has kind of shown what the sort of metagame aspect of that game will be. And it's essentially a entirely cosmetic loot system where you can, after every game you get points and they level you up, and you can level up forever. There's no cap and you don't unlock anything by leveling up. There's everything sort of game related is available from the start for every character and so on. So the entire game is there because it's built around character switching. So they kind of lock themselves out of being able to do that. And, but when you level up, you get a loot crate and you open the loot crate and you'll get four things of various rarities, and they include spray paints, sort of Half-Life style spray paints, which are character specific, voice lines, emotes, other skins for characters, and so on, different levels of rarity. The coolest stuff that's in there that I've seen so far, because the good thing about the beta now is it's all available to preview, is you can unlock custom animations, not only for the victory screen when you see your own character having won, but custom cinematic introductions to your own best plays. Because the game does this thing where when you finish a match, it will pick out one play of the game, one player on either team, regardless of who won, who did usually the best kill streak or something, like best individual play. And then they'll show a replay of that play from the player's perspective, which is, you know, a cool kind of bragging rights thing. You can now unlock like one of three different custom cinematic intros to all of those plays for every single character in the game. And they'll have their own ones, like swinging in on a grappling hook, freeze framing at the camera, or like, you know, firing a lot of rockets and stuff.
How does that switch into game footage?
It'll do that. At the moment, just like play of the game, this guy, and it shows you a picture of that guy.
Ah, right.
And okay. It'll replace the picture of that, the relatively static image, with a more dynamic kind of wrestling style intro for you. Okay. So it's all stuff like that. And the best thing about it is that it's all totally meaningless to the game itself. That it's all just stuff that you'll probably want if you get enough into it. And some of the skins are really cool. They've done a lot of work on them. It's a lot like HOTS, actually, where there are like a substantial number of color variants for all the basic looking characters, and then skins with their own color variants. But unlike that being something you pay for most of the time, or something you spend points on that you might otherwise be spending on in proper in-game stuff that you want, it is just level up and get this. The fact that it's a loot chest system suggests buying chests, because that's kind of what that means in every other context. And in an interview with PC Gamer, Blizzard did sort of say that they weren't ruling that out, but they weren't also ruling it in. But it's money. So you think that means in most of the time? Like 90% of the time, people are like, this, you know, they say they'll do it if the demand is there. But whose demand and for what is the
our demand for money.
Yeah. But game's still great. Play a little bit. The game itself doesn't feel like it's materially changed, although it feels like it's moved on a lot since the last beta in terms of presentation and stuff. It's still shaping up, I think, to be one of the coolest games of this year in terms of multiplayer stuff, because it's super, super, super slick. And it's actually refreshing. The other game that I've been playing a lot of recently, having come to it super late, so I'm not going to go on it in a podcasty way because it's been talked about so much, is Rainbow Six Siege.
a classic game.
Which is a brilliant game, really genuinely brilliant game, but one where everyone told me for about a month that I should play it. I didn't have time. But it's a game where you probably would quite like to have had the option to have all of the stuff from the beginning to learn all of the characters and their interdependencies. It's not, I mean, it's an Overwatch of very different games, excepting the fact that they are FPSs with characters with abilities that meaningfully affect the strategies you can use and so on. In Overwatch's case, they decided that the game wouldn't work if every player didn't have access to every character all of the time. And in Rainbow Six, they've made the decision that you can sort of get away with it, which I think maybe in Rainbow Six's case you can a little bit more, but still it does make a difference. And I am increasingly weary of unlock systems of any kind, really. I just want all of the stuff so that I can figure out what I like doing rather than spending points blind, you know, as in Rainbow Six, to find out that, oh, I actually don't like this guy or whatever.
Yeah, or this character was designed when there's presumably more of a single-player mode that then got axed.
Yeah.
It's otherwise completely functionally useless in multiplayer. Yeah. Sorry, so we went.
Which Siege character is that?
IQ, I think it is.
I thought apart from...
Myla Toss, although she does have better guns, I think.
She has really good guns. IQ.
She's quite nippy.
She's very fast. She has three brilliant guns, which no other character has.
Best class in the game.
Yep.
Bullshit.
And there's a completely bullshit thing you can do with her crap ability that takes advantage of the fact that smoke is rendered client side.
Oh, really?
You can see through smoke grenades with her flip-up screen. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, a bullshit thing you can do with a crap ability.
It is bullshit, and it's not supposed to work that way, but it does. And she's all right, sort of. I have to credit a very good Rainbow Six Siege YouTuber called Serenity17 for that insight.
Oh, right. Okay.
Excellent mini guides by a pro player. Helped me not be totally shit at that game that I love, but I'm totally shit at it. Anyway. What have you been playing, Marty?
Been playing all kinds of things this week.
Not really.
I finished off The Witness and Tomb Raider. Should we talk about that briefly?
Yeah. I've got to... The Witness is an island with a bunch of different sections on it, and each section you complete connects a laser to a mountain, and it's evident right from the start that you need to connect enough of them to open some kind of thing on the mountain.
Hmm.
And then that gets you into the last bit of the game. And so it is true that you don't have to do all the sections, which is great, because there was a section I just didn't want to do, and so I just didn't do it. And now I'm in the final stage, and I thought that was like, I was just like, right, I'm going to wrap up The Witness tonight. I know I've unlocked the last thing, and I'm going to go in there. And the last section, obviously, I won't say anything about what's in it, but it's visually cool. And then I got to the puzzles in it, and I was just like, oh, there's just a lot of them. And I get the concept. The concept's quite cool, but then after you get the concept, the actual kind of executing bit of it just takes a lot of time, and just it's just the puzzle here is simple, but it's just awkward to actually do it. And
they get better though, actually. It's actually quite a long ending section, and the first like trio of puzzle segments to it I thought were hot bullshit. I really didn't like any of them, and I found them laborious and not particularly interesting in any way. But then the kind of final set of puzzles is kind of exquisite.
Lovely maze.
They are still maze puzzles, yes. Although it's interesting, like I can't wait to hear your take. Are you going to finish it?
Yeah, I think I will.
I think you should, even if
I
you
need
don't
to do it in bursts.
Puzzles, just you know, go through it with a tutorial or something, just so you can, because the final thing in the game, I think is probably going to prove very, very divisive. It's not a racist maze. Well, that's not
you do often have to divide black from white in these mazes, actually.
Shit. I haven't played The Witness yet, I should stress.
Well, a very cool developer friend of mine called Philip Back was talking about this to me, and he said he was actually drew attention to the fact that it's the Swedish aspirations of the game, or philosophical aspirations of the game, if you want to be more kind of kind to it, do actually reflect in the puzzle mechanics certain kinds of things that stop you from attaining enlightenment in a broad sense. So actually kind of like separating black from white is a kind of crude way of saying, well, you know, segregation as a sort of thing is perhaps a way in which we stumble as a species finding enlightenment. I don't know whether that goes all the way through, because I don't think there is a great kind of social problem in identifying the sequence of notes in a wolf howl. But it is, I kind of think there probably is more to it that I'm missing. But yeah, I think the final thing to it is, it's not like there's a great, it's not like a substantial
boss fight.
It's just kind of like the final flourish of the game, which does something kind of cool. But at the same time, I was like, fuck you, John. Fuck you, John Blow.
Interesting.
So yeah, I want to know how other people react to it. But Tomb Raider, I've been up and down on this game because unlike Chris, I quite liked the first game.
I quite liked the first one.
Okay, yeah.
I gave it the score that means you quite like it, 75.
I was also angry about it.
Just didn't
way that you
wet myself, that's all.
Right, no. I think, yeah, I'm quite sure why it got the adulation it got.
Neither do I.
But it's certainly pretty. But the second game seems to kind of make good in a lot of some of the errors of the first game. It seems to be... seems to have kind of more broad systemic mechanics, larger kind of hub levels that actually require you to properly explore them and go back and round them. It gives you a reason to stay in those areas for a while rather than just plow through them in a linear way.
Lots of good side tombs.
Good side tombs.
Although the one with the rafts on the strong current.
That didn't make any sense.
After I'd got to the objective on that, just getting back took me like three times as long as it did to get there. I just couldn't figure it out. And every time you fail, that is one of its few
instant deaths.
Yeah, instant death, and also like brutal cutscene of Lara being smashed on rocks. And then you've got to go back, you know, a ways and do it all again. And that was irritating.
It kind of undoes some of the problems of linearity that the first game and all games of that kind face, but at the same time, it doubles down on some of the other problems in a big way. The writing is just total dreck. It's interesting though that the writing and the dialogue is appalling, and yet some of the kind of item descriptions you pick up and give you a little story behind them. It's like audio diaries, but they're scrolls.
You know, textio diaries.
some of those are quite well written, I thought, and not totally dumb. Can't say that for the rest of the game, unfortunately.
Yeah, I've been actually reading most of those, but they're done in a strange way where, like, you use the item, or if it's like for something written, then you use the document and takes you to a screen with the text on it, and they read it out, which is expensive for them to do because they've got to have
and harder acted. For me to parse actually,
and and annoying for me because I certainly can't read ahead of the voice, and I don't want to read at the same speed of the voice, and so what I end up doing is pausing the voice and then just reading the text by itself, which is bad both because wastes their effort voice acting, and also I can't get on with the game until I'm done with it.
Yeah.
And it would have been way better if you just, it brings it up and it's like text, but if you close out, the audio should carry on playing, I think.
Yeah. And the other thing is that those little kind of narrative snippets can only ever be trivial. Which is kind of, I don't know what else they can do really.
But quite a nice series of them where you follow like one of the enemy soldiers. There's one enemy soldier who leaves a lot of audio diaries, and that was quite a nice little insight into them because apart from that one guy, they're the most generic bad faction ever.
Yeah, there's some quite good stuff about somebody who's been following this this prophet who's an essential engineer, and his family have all died, but everybody else doesn't want to tell him. And that's actually really good. I thought it was good. But whenever I sit down at a campfire and Lara starts talking, I immediately cancel and stand up and then sit down again so I don't have to listen to her because she's an idiot. That's the most disappointing thing. Like, I've got such a kind of, innate boner for archaeology and stuff like this. That could have gone in a weird way. But
the phrase innate boner is the...
it's an ingrowing boner.
So Lara will say something like, oh, they embalmed their dead. Interesting. And we're like, why is that interesting? That could be interesting. Why don't you tell me why that's interesting, archaeologist with a great deal of learning? Because there are really interesting things to say about the way in which cultures treated their dead, and where that moved across the globe is a source of contention, because there were mummies that came from certain places which were treated in a certain way, which was unusual, which is unheard of, and it turned out that they were faked mummies because they didn't know that. And so it's like a controversy which is interesting in archaeology, and so to kind of just it's just like It's just like they've read up a series of bullet points about interesting things archaeologists might say for 3 seconds and just written that. And it's like, I don't know. I feel like in an Uncharted game, you do actually get more. Oh, maybe not. I don't know. Maybe I'm being uncharitable.
Like, Uncharted has that.
Unchartedable.
Uncharted has the sort of the history of it is nonsense.
Yeah.
But it's nonsense in the same way that the present in that game is nonsense.
Yeah.
Which is kind of why it works. Like, the first game is like, you know, I bet Francis Drake, you know, actually faked his death on an adventure to stop some zombies or something.
Yeah.
Like, that's, and, you know, and then, you know, as you progress, you're finding out more about the history of Francis Drake, which is half sort of the right kinds of places in ships and era of history and stuff like that to give it a little hint of historical accuracy, but is otherwise total nonsense, except taken in the light of what happens to Nathan Drake.
Yeah.
In which case you can believe that there's an Uncharted Zero where you control Francis Drake just fucking driving jeeps off cliffs and stuff.
They should make that.
They should make it.
I kind of want. I like the way that Assassin's Creed deals with history. Actually, in that it just
stab it. Stab it in the throat.
No, because the people they obviously employ people who actually genuinely have a love of that time period,
there really is.
And they've done a good job of communicating that through flavor text and through information about, you know, Pope's, you know, embezzling money and stuff like this, which actually happen. And I feel that look, there's so much opportunity for that. You know, she picks up this kind of fetish, which has obviously been that's just to be clear, a statue, which is a fetish, which is obviously the artists have researched this and they based it on the particular culture's kind of you know, fertility statuettes. And that learning has gone into the game and then just died there. But it doesn't come back out again. And that's really frustrating because it's such, I'd love the fantasy of being an amazing archaeologist going and seeing cool ancient shit.
Yeah. And she is, like, they've got so much of it. Like, you discover these places, and particularly the hidden tombs are quite well done in terms of, like, how they're hidden and stumbling. You don't really stumble upon them because it tells you there's one nearby. But
yeah.
The big on-screen message.
Giant prompt.
But it's usually some time between it telling me that and me actually finding it. And then when you do find it, there's this nice feeling of like, oh, if you just break down this wall, there's a thing behind it. And then when you go in it, because all of them are uniquely designed and proper, like, specific set pieces, there's always a moment of like, whoa, look at that.
Imagine if Time Team had that on-screen prompt. It'd be great. Like, oh, there's a hidden tomb around here.
If that was also like if the information you got there was like specific and actually about either real cultures or fictitious cultures, but coherent ones that, you know, felt meaningful, that would be even more exciting. The thing I'm really liking about it, basically, it's just they've got these like several modes of game that they want to get in there. So one is platforming, and one is like exploration, one is survival. One is obviously shooting guards in a forced combat situation where stealth is not a possibility, running away is not a possibility, everyone has to be killed, and you have to do it with the, like,
that is the worst part of that.
Yeah, it's fucking terrible. And then there's a stealth bit, and or stealth type, and early on that's pretty rare. You get like a couple short bits early on, and there's loads of skills devoted to it. So I kept on choosing all the skills because stealth. And I was kind of just thinking to myself, this is silly, because I know from my experience so far, stealth is like 5% of the game and the rest of it's all this other stuff. But then, like, the bit I'm in, I think I'm in the sort of coming towards the end of the, or coming towards like the 2/3 mark. And there's been like a series of really long stealth sections that are just great. There's really big areas just crawling with guards, and it's just totally up to you how you take them out. And I've got loads of cool abilities to like do drop attacks, and I can booby trap corpses so that people wander over and get a gas explosion that stealth kills them. I can like lock on to 3 different enemies and headshot them all with the bow, which is kind of ridiculous.
Cool. But the thing is that's...
You can throw stuff to distract people.
It's just situational enough that's not... I mean, it is overpowered, probably, but it's actually that you start not shooting people because you want to line up a headshot with 3 of them to do it efficiently. And that gives you kind of some kind of extra challenge that probably wouldn't be there if you were doing it one by one.
I've also upgraded my pistol with a silencer, so I can use that as well as bows, and I've just got loads of cool stealth tools.
There's a really great hub area later on that feels really underused, but it's strange. It comes straight after the lowest point in that game, probably most games, which is a weird situation where you're forced into forced combat, and then you have to hide from a bunch of dudes who are walking over this ice sheet, and there's lots of these holes in it. There's two of these sequences, but the later one is way weirder and stupider, because you can't escape. You can't jump out of the ice sheet because they'll kill you instantly with guns. They'll just gun you down. There's loads and loads of them. And so what you kind of have to do is just kind of swim back and forth between these holes in the ice. Wait until a guard comes over to you. Their guards are on constant aggro, as far as I can tell. It doesn't matter where you are.
Yeah.
They know where you are underneath this ice sheet. And wait, and then do this kind of janky, kind of broken animation to pull them down into the water, at which point you're invulnerable to the bullets that are being pulled and shot into you by all the other guards. And then you just have like maybe half a second invulnerability window to kind of paddle under the ice so they can't shoot you anymore. And you repeat the same thing. It's the most unrewarding. You have to do it like 16 times or something.
That took
ridiculous.
A long time.
it's nightmarish. But then later there's a city in underneath a glacier, which is it feels quite a lot like a Dark Souls level, actually, in the way it's presented. But it's the most exciting place in the game in terms of the traversal mechanics, because instead of seeking to direct you down any single path through it, they've just covered every side of every building with all of the possible traversal options that you've previously found in the game in isolated instances. And it means, excuse me, initially it's a stealth section, so there are some guards wandering around in the streets below that you can murderize if you want. But it doesn't really give you much of a reason to piss around there. It's a real shame, because it's the time when you most use your ingenuity in traversing the levels, because you're not just essentially doing a Simon Says button prompt over a sequence of obstacles that you can see in a linear path in front of you. You're actually saying, okay, I'm going to go over there. I'm going to use this. I'm going to go dirt. I'm going to grapple onto this motherfucking thing. And it's great. And then it does do quite a cool switcheroo, where it then chases you back through that area, and suddenly you need to use all of your knowledge of having properly explored that in working out how to get across it really quickly. And that's actually kind of cool. I mean, like, it feels somewhat disappointing to throw it away so quickly as it does. But I think it's one of the kind of shining moments of the otherwise slightly shoddy game, I think. It's nosediving in quality. The closer it gets to its cinematic ending, it's just kind of becoming more and more linear. But, yeah. Mm. Talking of linear games, I don't really have any forced combat in it. I played an hour of Firewatch.
Mm.
What do you think of it?
It's real nice so far. I don't really know what to make of it. It's a walking simulator, I suppose we could say that. You are a fire lookout. It introduces your backstory, your fucking tragic backstory, in a series of pseudo branching dialogue tree, not dialogue tree, like Twine style text. What the fuck am I trying to say? I don't
know. Interactive fiction.
There you go. Thank you. I wasn't super enamored with, because it is just so brutally tragic out of the gates in a way which I find really personally hurtful. I was just like, oh, Christ, oh, come on. I just wanted to, you know, spend an hour playing a nice thing where I wander around nature.
It didn't sort of wasn't sort of hurtful to me in itself, but it kind of changed the tone of the rest of the experience, because it's not a tragic past. It's a kind of tragic present. It's still going on. And there's something sort of quite pressing about it. And so I couldn't... Mm. I was really immersed in it and really, like, into the story. Like, I was taking it very seriously. And so I just couldn't let Henry have any fun. There was no possibility. There's a lot of things that are quite lighthearted and kind of playful about it. And I just shut it all down as soon as I came. I'm just, no, fuck off. This is too serious. And it's such a beautiful, relaxing, it's basically like a holiday. Like, the game itself is like taking a holiday in this beautiful place. But I didn't feel like Henry could, I didn't feel like Henry should be having a holiday. And so, like, it was a weird tension there.
Yeah. It's strange. I mean, you can credit it with enough deftness that it doesn't feel like it's cheaply tugging your heartstrings. But it does come right out the gate with something which is just boldly tragic in a way which would feel really manipulative in most other contexts. And you just have to say, well, okay, well, we're going with that, are we? Fucking hell. And then it opens up into this, you know, beautiful wilderness, which you are exploring in not freely because they are quite trammeled paths, but there is a certain amount of leeway with the directions that you go, I think. Yeah. I think you can step off the path pretty quickly, actually, and go wherever you want, but you are not then fulfilling your objectives as you would if you obeyed the narrative.
You can, as you go along, because it's all in the same area, you sort of learn all the routes and you, after a while, you know, oh, I know the best way to get to Cedarwood Creek or whatever. Mm. Which is cool.
It's very pretty. One of the things I love about it so far is just picking up all the items in the game. You can pick it. It has a really nice...
I never found the turtle. There's a turtle and I never found it.
A turtle?
Yeah, in one of the screenshots, he's picking up a turtle.
Oh, wow. I certainly haven't found that yet. I assume that's probably near the lake. But it has a really nice button configuration, which I haven't experienced in other games before. Both when you're selecting dialogue answers. It took me a little kind of while to get into the headspace of it, but it really works nicely. And then there's a nice, really tactile thing where you pick up stuff and you can manipulate it. But it doesn't feel quite like you would in other games. I'm quite sure why. But but obviously, every fucking item in that game, all the labels on it, all the book covers have been designed by Ollie Moss, probably one of the greatest living graphic designers on the planet, who has singularly dogged my illustration career and always done the same things as me, but like three times better. It's really fucking irritating. I hope he dies. But it does make the game a delight to play. So I've been, you know, picking up a nice, like, bottle of washing up liquid and going, wow, that's a much better label than washing up liquid bottles deserve. That's great. You have a constant radio conversation with somebody else who's in another Firewatch tower. That I found the dialogue pretty funny. I wasn't quite into it initially. I thought it felt a bit kind of stagey, but actually, the dialogue answers are pretty funny, I think, a lot of the time.
Yeah, for the most part, I really love their performances. In particular, Henry just has this great way of... So much of the stuff you do is quite ordinary. Like, a lot of time, you're not in any life-threatening danger. You're just kind of investigating stuff, just checking out, oh, what's that over there? And you report loads of things to Delilah, and you can say something about almost everything. And so a lot of the time, you're telling her things that aren't that important. And that's something that... most video game acting performances would not cope with at all. In fact, don't cope with in their own games. Every line has to be delivered like acting and must have an emotional overtone to it. And Henry's really good at just saying like, yeah, it looks like this line's cut, and just reporting things in a matter-of-fact way that's not, that doesn't sound like acting.
It's quite a good contrast with Metal Gear 5, actually, where you can report anything want to Ocelot, who will explain why this thing you're looking at is sort of relevant to the broader course of international independent war.
This potato, like, first found in Sierra Leone, etc.
This carrot
wild
is a
wild carrot, ancestor of a...
and so on.
Yeah.
Not very good at it. He never just says, that's a carrot.
So. Yeah, that's definitely the other end of the scale.
Yeah, I like it. There is an emerging mystery now, which I won't spoil, which is obviously, I don't know where that's possibly going to go, but it's quite interesting so far.
Is it something it shares with Gone Home, actually, is that the whole time that the mystery is going on, you still don't know what genre you know what genre the game is, it's a walking simulator, but you don't know what genre the fiction is, whether
we joked about Firewatch Sasquatch.
Yeah.
It could still happen. It's wide open.
But that's what I like, is that you just don't even know what kind of thing, you know, if this is a book, you wouldn't know what genre it was.
The only thing I don't like about it so far is that I have to manually retract my map and compass in order to step over a log.
Really?
I think I can handle that. Actually, like in real life, I'm okay.
Do you think you can handle that in real life? You can look at a compass, hold a map, and step over a log at the same time.
I wouldn't say I'd have 100% success rate, but like at least 40, 50.
I wish we could test that.
Plus, it might get a critical
hit. Science, I'm afraid. Talking of critical hits. I was going to segue. Maybe I segued too early.
Your segue is better than what I was going to say.
Oh, I'm sure that's not true.
I was just going to say that I'd never had the log problem exactly, but you can't sprint with your map out, and you want to sprint a lot. And I wish sprinting just put the map away automatically. There you go.
Talking of critical hits
and sprinting
yeah,
does that? Dashing,
kind of.
Really.
Dashing,
technically dashing.
You've been playing more XCOM.
Yes. Sorry. I didn't know I was meant to pick it up from that. XCOM 2. I had not played it at all last week, I don't think. only Tom had.
Oh, yeah.
And now I have. And my initial experience with it was terrible.
Really?
It is. It's brutally hard. And also just loads of things have changed in ways that just defy your intuition and expectations. And very few of them communicated well. And because it's so brutally difficult, everything that you fuck up because you didn't understand something is just game over, virtually. Oh. Like, I mean, initially, the first mission, you have to win. So if you lose all your people, which I did three times, you literally can't progress. It just, you have to do the whole mission again. And, or you can, it actually does autosave very frequently. So you can go back and, to a previous save, but then your save's coming. And that's terrible. It's the worst way to play XCOM, is going back to a previous save and doing things differently because now you know that would have worked out, or just hoping that the chance will work out differently.
No shame in that. No shame in that.
Wouldn't be above it if it would make the game more fun, but I think it really ruins the game. I really don't like doing it. And so I'd have to restart the whole mission each time, because then at least it regenerates the mission. And I was just dying to stuff like, I made videos of this because I was so angry about it, but I had two people. I didn't cluster my people, even though I'd never seen a grenade. I thought, let's not keep my people really close together, because then I could potentially lose two of them at once, and that would be disastrous. But I had them hiding in the only good cover that there is in the main channel of that map, which is some big vehicles. And I think it was the first fight of the game, an enemy trooper shot at one of my people who's hiding behind some crates on top of a truck. And he missed, and he hit the crates, and the crates splintered into wood, and then the entire truck exploded, an explosion that killed that person and my other troop. Wiped out half my team. I only had four people, that killed two of them in just one shot that missed. And so then I thought, okay, well, let's stay well away from vehicles then. And also, like, let's shoot some fucking vehicles, the aliens go near it. Because I stood way away from the trucks. It's really difficult to do that, but it takes a lot more turns to get to your objective and you're under a time limit. But I stood way away from the trucks, and that meant the aliens came up to the trucks and hung around near them. And the most problematic alien on that level was standing right next to a truck. I thought, fucking brilliant. Move my guy up, throw a grenade at the truck. You can't shoot it. You're not allowed to target it. Even though it's the most potent explosive barrel in the world, you can't intentionally shoot it. Even though shooting it just once would completely annihilate everyone near it, and it would be a brilliant tactical move. So I threw a grenade at it, and it didn't blow up. And the alien was completely unharmed. And then he, like, destroyed some of my people.
Did it blow up a couple of times later?
Yeah.
Because that's the XCOM thing.
So that's what I'm used to from Enemy Unknown. Is like something that takes damage, and then like at the end of the next turn it blows up. And so I'm used to that. But my first experience with it was just an enemy shot it, and just immediately from not being damaged at all, killed half my team.
Chance that it was on fire before that, but
no, it
didn't
like right
render
at the start
the flames
of the
or something.
Well, I suppose
because just because I've had some experience with visual effects not showing up.
But it was literally the first attack of the game, so nothing else could have damaged it in gameplay.
Yeah, fair enough.
It could have been pre-coded. But I mean, just in general, which vehicles can and will blow up is so unclear to me. Just every single time, like, that one's on fire, so maybe that means it's going to blow up, and then it never does. And the next one, oh, that one's on fire, so maybe it means it can't blow up, and then it does blow up. That one's brand new, so that one can blow up. Yep. That one looks, you know, gutted and doesn't have an engine anymore, so it can't blow up. Oh, it does blow up. And it's always fatal. Every single time you get that wrong, you've lost at least one of your people, sometimes half your team. And so that's just, you know, with experience, I'll learn it. And there's a bunch of other things like that where you get to the objective and it's got a big icon on it that says click left mouse, and clicking left mouse does nothing. And clicking right mouse, if you do it, uses up the rest of your turn to move you to an adjacent square, which you didn't click on. Because right mouse is the move button, and it just finds the nearest place you can move to. So it ends your turn, moves you out of cover, moves you away from the objective, and, you know, that's it. It's game over. That troop is lost now forever. And so the punishment for failure is so severe that when you're playing this is on veteran difficulty, which is the second of four difficulties and the default one, and the one recommended for previous XCOM players. But there are so many things I didn't understand about the game, and the penalty for getting any of them wrong was so completely disastrous that I just wasn't enjoying it. And so I did get through the first mission on that difficulty level on my fourth attempt. And then on the, like, I had one or two successful missions. My successful attempt at that mission, by the way, was shit. I fucked it up like three different ways, but just through luck of the draw, we won. And then the next mission, I screwed up in a bunch of ways again, partly because I saw some enemies, and then on their turn, the camera moved away from them, and you can't control the camera on the enemy turn, and then they moved. And now when the camera goes back, I don't know where they moved to. And I would have realistically been able to see where they moved to, but the camera just decided not to show me that. Right. So I fucked up because they were actually on a roof. And so they came down and surprised me, which was irritating. But then we just completely won that mission flawlessly anyway because of luck. And then on like the mission after that, I lost my entire team because I didn't complete the mission within the time limit. Because it was a mission type I'd never had before, and I didn't realize you had to pick up the VIP and then get them all the way over to the objective point. And it was further away than I realized, and so we had one turn left, and that means all of your team are lost.
What?
They all get captured.
Yeah.
And so I knew, like, I'd risked one person, and they got injured, and I was thinking, oh, it's not worth risking this VIP. I don't even know what the benefit of it is, so it's not worth risking my men's lives to get him out within the time limit, because it said, turns until a forced retreat. Forced retreat. Fine, let's do a forced retreat. Forced retreat means all your people are captured and you get nothing back. I think it means the dropship has to force. Yeah, it's forced retreat.
It means the dropship is forced away. Yeah.
So that wasn't clear to me, and that was like all of my people. That was the only people, except for one. It was four of my five people who had any rank at all. So I'm left with nobody left, and so that's the point that I brought the difficulty down. And since then, it's been great.
The only reason I knew about the force retreat thing, what it actually meant, is because there is a couple of voice barks that like your command person will say that's like, we've got a turn and then the dropship has to go. And like they have loads of different variants on those lines, but it's not clear from the actual wording you see all of the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just loads of little things like that, which are sort of understandable in themselves. But then when they literally lose your entire team, it's too high a price to pay. So I moved the difficulty down and it's been way better since then. And now I've become completely addicted to it and I'm getting really, really into it. The coolest thing is basically the same thing as Enemy Unknown, which is just how much character your soldiers end up having, not through, you know, what they say or anything that the game sort of scripts, but just through the decisions you make about who you name them after, how you dress them, what happens to them during the missions. There's one of the cool new things is that, I think it's new. If a soldier takes enough damage and goes through enough trauma in a mission, they become shaken, which means that their will goes down to zero, which means they're very prone to panicking and very prone to any kind of mind control or anything like that. And the only way they can become unshaken is to go on a mission, kill an alien, and get out without taking any damage. So they have to have a good mission, basically. And so,
wow, that's the way to cure PTSD.
Yes, you just got to get a good, clean kill, man. It'll set your brain right. And so, like, on the last mission I did, you know, one of my best people was shaken. And, in fact, two of my best people were shaken, so I decided to leave one at home and only bring one in. Because I thought, you know, if I've got to guarantee this person doesn't take any damage, I can do that for one person, but probably not two. And also gave her a special psionic, like a mind shield, which is like a special device that uses up one of her inventory slots to make sure she can't be mind controlled or panicked. And then basically just had to babysit her and just make sure, like everyone else, like, okay, there's two enemies out in the open. We've got this brilliant opportunity to ambush. We're definitely going to annihilate them. But you guys just hold off. Just let her get the kill. And then she gets the kill and feels better.
I've had a sort of similar, but the other side of this, I don't know. I've had a better experience of Veteran than you had. Because my take on the game is how punishing it is. And I'm still feeling out a couple of hours in how much of that is recoverable. Because I haven't lost a mission in the way that has cost me the game yet. Like, I'm not very far in, but like, that first mission, the one you're talking about, I did first time, but I lost one person. And I lost my most experienced soldier. But it felt kind of right, like she died when she did, because she was like securing the objective and just sort of put herself in harm's way to make sure we got the objective and died. So that very early sort of seeded this idea that like, I'm going to lose my best people. And then for a while after that, like another guy was injured, and injuries are a big deal because someone's out for a long time when they're injured, and like 9 days feels like a long time if someone takes a lot of hits. And so after that, I had this sort of A team of four like incredibly badass women that like, because that was just the random generator sort of threw up, including this kind of like sniper with a shaved head and aviators.
I had a sniper with a shaved head and aviators.
Yeah,
and
she looks fucking rad. And it was just such a cool kind of like group of people like walking off the ship, and like, and everything went pretty well after that. I'd take injuries, but very few casualties, and I'm sort of progressing, and I build up into that sort of XCOM kind of status quo where you have your A team, you know, and they started to develop, new characters emerge, including this like really great, this is a specialist, which is the one that gets a drone, and the drone can hack things and kind of fly around. But they're also pretty good soldiers in their own case. And I had this, like, because I always let the stories develop around the randomly generated characters. Like, I don't tend to change their names or redesign them. I'll change their, like, my rule is, like, I won't change anything that you can't easily change about a person. So I don't change their nationality, name.
Your name is Tom.
Or their look. Or, like, their, you know, their face or their, or whatever. But, you know, I might, you know, change hair or, like, the hat they're wearing or their armor or the coloring of their armor and weapons and stuff. And I ended up with this really rad sort of hack. Like, so this, my highest ranking soldier was a specialist from the Netherlands called Rika Dekker. And so Dekker is an amazing name for someone who hacks things with a kind of cool cyberpunk drone anyway. And then she gained the call sign Whiskey, which was kind of like perfect. And then I had her in like this sort of urban camo with, you know, like this sort of like, yeah, like blue and black urban camo with a beanie. And like, and she looks fucking cool. Like, I really love the visual design of new XCOM, where it's halfway between just a resistance wearing whatever they can find and the old XCOM of like professional special forces. And so, and you can sort of steer it and to either end of that extreme from like wearing their own clothes to a bit like when in Enemy Within, when you first got the ability to send your soldiers off on like solo assignments and you'd see them in their plain clothes for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of thing. Totally. Sort of feels like it's got elements of that in it. And so I had this real cool sense of who this character was. And then, Big Time, who's this sniper, like the aviator sign. And like, you know, eventually I gained this, like, Japanese guy who became a ranger, which is the one with the sword. And so, like, it just feels like a sort of super badass kind of like squadron. And then I get the first retaliation mission, which is the new version of a terror mission, whereas rather than the aliens coming down hard on a pit of the populace and you having to defend them, it's Advent, the new kind of alien government, going after a friendly resistance cell and just trying to wipe them from the face of the earth. And you have to come in and try and save as many of them possible. And functionally, it is the same as the old terror missions, but you know, the terror mission in XCOM 1 is like a really good barometer for how well the rest of the campaign's going to go. Like, if you can get to that terror mission and get through it, that game, the problem with that game, which is otherwise a brilliant game, is if you get through the terror mission and you're basically all right, the rest of the game will get easier. You'll get better weapons, you'll get better armor, you'll eventually be overpowered for the things you're going into. And it's not because of your success of the terror mission, but often how well you're doing at that point, particularly if you're doing like Iron Man on a high difficulty, that's the barometer for whether you have the tools you need to do well after that point. And I did it. Like, I went through that mission and I think I maybe lost one person. No, I didn't even lose anybody on the retaliation mission, got through it and like feeling like rolling. And then I went to do the first story mission, which is something you have to do, to kind of move the plot along. And I had this amazing fucking terrible sequence of events where we'd found we'd ambushed the first patrol, killed them, moved up to a train yard basically and clambering over the train equipment. And it reveals the first turret I'd ever seen. And Whiskey, the hacker, I send the drone up and try and do the gamble on getting the better hacking result, which is the one where you take over the turret for a couple of turns. Oh, yeah. So she sends her drone up to this rooftop, takes over the turret, and then I put the turret on overwatch. Then I move everybody into position sort of so that they would be in the turret's line of fire, but they're not because it's ours now. And this kind of triggers the Advent soldiers and sectoids and stuff to come running out from the building that we're attacking. And it's this, you know, awesome moment of the entire squad kind of opening fire, and then the turret moves in and like annihilates one of the sectoids. And I'm like, this is fucking great. At which point, the worst possible thing that could happen happens, which is one of the sectoids causes Whiskey the hacker to panic. So it uses the panic power on her. And if this is the AI doing it, that's really fucking clever. Because what that means is she loses control of the turret.
All right. I thought you were going to say you mind controlled her, because that would probably have the same effect, I imagine.
Mind control would, but this all it needs to do is make her panic. So she panics, at which point the turret goes back to being like, and this is like the horror, this is the moment from the war movie that XCOM forms, where the turret, like the light goes red again and all of my people are exposed because they weren't, like, I was getting, like, the next turn is the turn we get under the shadow of the building, we're out of line of sight. We needed that one turn of having it under control. And suddenly, like, one person gets shot at by the turret and panics immediately. Somebody else gets knocked unconscious by a, like, taser sword thing that happens. And everyone else is in complete disarray. And basically, the mission totally collapses from there. and I lost everybody. Like, they just get picked apart. And I'm not playing, there's no Iron Man mode you pick, but I'm just not save scumming. So it's when they, you know, when the two people who finish panicking, like, you know, we'd already lost one person, which caused somebody else to panic. And then Whiskey goes and grabs the body of the person who's unconscious because you have to carry them, and I couldn't revive her. And then gets gunned down by the turret while trying to get into cover. And I have one guy left, and I managed to get to the objective, which is something you need to take and leave the mission area with. And he gets it. And then it's my only guy left. And as he's leaving the building, all this fucking Advent dropships come flying in. I knew he's fucked. So he's just running for the drop zone, and you just see him, and he just gets completely gunned down. And everyone's gone. And it goes, and the mission, you know, doesn't end the campaign. Just mission is over. And at that point, I had that pull of like, do I restart now? Yeah. Cause I've lost everything. Apart from cool sniper with aviators who was injured for that mission. So she wasn't there, and she was injured for a long time. And eventually I pull back a new squad and then send them on a mission where I could only send three people because it's all I had. And I had the squad upgrade at this point. I had five tops. Send them on a mission to like, just because it was a mission to blow up a communications relay. But if I did it, I got a crew member because I had no supplies. I have nothing. Right. Like, I have no money. I've got no way of getting new people. So the three people I can send, succeed at that on that mission, but one guy has to die for it to happen. And that ends with this incredibly clutch thing where they mind control the cool sniper, who then shoots my other soldier in the back, but that soldier then does this Hail Mary shot on the sectoid that's mind controlling the other one, and they both survive, and ends with them throwing grenades into the building to blow up the communications relay, and done. Next mission, the one who made that clutch play dies, and lose another two people. And now I'm at this point where it's the cool sniper, who survived a lot of shit at this point, and four complete rookies. And the mission I just did was a VIP extraction mission with the same timer of, you know, 10, you got 10, you know, eventually you got to get out.
This is a great Band of Brothers storyline, yeah, though.
And at this point, I know I can't get them all out. There's one fucking Advent soldier left, but the evac zone is on the roof of a three-story building. And cool sniper is knocked unconscious again by a taser sword. So I have one guy, it's her and four rookies. One of the rookies just puts him over her over his shoulders, and I just send him and the VIP running for the evac zone, and all of the rest of them, they mathematically they can't get there in time. They can't move enough squares. They are not getting to the evac zone, so they just stay behind and like hold off this advent.
Wow.
As like, and then I get, and then it cuts to like the end of the mission thing, and when soldiers return to your base ship thing, they're like, if they're wounded, they're limping and staggering. And sometimes they collapse onto their knees as they get to the base. And it's this thing where only two of them come back and the VIP. And then it just flashes up with like captured, captured, captured for the other three, which feels like a really cool, appropriate ending. And now I'm excited to see if that changes things, because that mission was actually to rescue a captured XCOM soldier, but it wasn't one I'd already had. But I wonder if it will generate those missions for the ones who have already been taken.
That's actually the main reason I didn't restart when I lost all my people. They all got captured. I thought, either stay on the same difficulty and restart, or I lower the difficulty and carry on. So I lower the difficulty and carried on because I still am hoping one day I'm going to find them again. And it's been like 10 hours since then and none of them have come up.
Yeah. But like, so this is the situation I'm in with it now, is I've hit setbacks that in old XCOM I would have considered, all right, new campaign, this is fucked. But I haven't failed yet. And it may well be that I'm too far back relative to the pace of the things you've got to stay ahead of in terms of surviving, that ultimately I'll fail. But I'm kind of willing to see that, because I want to see what happens. And kind of like, the more I play, the more I'll learn that will help the next one. But so far, it's like, it's not the campaign I thought I was going to have when I started out and I had my A team. But the fact that it's kept going and it's given me really cool stories, that's what's been really rewarding about it. Because you talk about games not really letting you fail and not really letting you see the consequences of failure. I really like that it lets you do that. Hmm. That like, this is not the most cinematically neat story, because the person who obviously emerges as a hero died in a really tragic way, like her own hacked turret turned against her kind of thing. But with her gone, it's interesting seeing how the story's changed completely and like the new people that come through. And I really like that about it. And this is, so yeah, I could sort of, I have my frustrations with it as well. Like, I don't think it makes enemy line of sight clear enough. And sometimes they can shoot through walls in a way that feels really busted.
Yeah, it's mad.
But with that in mind, at the moment, I'm still pretty positive about the difficulty level, because it lets you have an experience that you wouldn't normally have in a game of well, this went as badly as I can imagine and the game hasn't ended.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm absolutely fine with just things going horribly wrong and me losing loads of good people. And the only reason I needed to reduce the difficulty was because almost every failure I'd had was due to interface. It was just, I had no way of knowing that was going to happen. Or I didn't know this could, the consequence of that would be this. And it's still brutal on the easiest difficulty. I'm still losing like really good people to really tragic stuff. But the, I love just sort of like coming up with stories for the people or kind of just different personalities. I haven't actually had too much kind of interesting relationships going on between the people, which I did have with XCOM Enemy Unknown, probably just through sheer chance. I think it just depends on how things work out. But like, I remember my main campaign for Enemy Unknown, I just had two people from my original squad who never died. Like everyone else would come and go and get killed. And then the only Alex Wiltshire and, Amanda, someone, I can't remember who, as I'm doing this time, I got, followers on Twitter to sort of volunteer to be names for my campaign. And those two had always survived. And I also like color people's armor according to when they came on the squad. So the initial squad all gets the same color armor. And then when I recruit new people, they'll get one color of armor. And the first time you're fielded, that determines what kind of color you get. And then that way I can look at a squad and say, oh yeah, those two are the originals and those ones came in later. And so it was just Alex and Amanda in white the whole time. And so they always got the best stuff and they're just always maximum possible rank. And so they, in my head, they were just married. That was just like their story is they're just married soldiers who've, been through all the shit together. And they're like the old hands as well. Like, you know, they've, sort of wise and world weary.
Very much like Alex Wiltshire.
Yeah, just like him in real life. Embittered sort of old grizzly veteran. and this time I think part of it is like, I haven't had anybody bleed out. It's always been instant death. So I had loads, like probably 15 people be killed, but no one's ever been in a situation where it was recoverable. And that was what led to those moments of like, I remember when X saved Y. But I'm pretty sure that stuff will come up. There's so much more personality stuff you can do. Like you say, sort of visual customization options are way better. So you can make kind of scrappy resistance fighters as well as, you know, heavily armored soldiers. And, you get weapon mods, which have to be permanently fixed to a weapon and, give quite good bonuses. And so they kind of give personality to the soldiers as well. Even if you have two of the same class who have the same abilities, particularly early on, everyone of the same class has, the same core ability. If they have different weapon mods, that gives them different personalities. And then you can name the weapons as well. And I think just recently I've gone through and named all of the weapons for all of my key people. And I know enough about who they are and what their personality is to know what they would call their gun at this point.
Yeah, I really like that stuff. My badass sniper now has a sort of swept over mohawk and like a cigarette hanging out of her mouth at all times. It looks fucking cool. Especially because they've done some really nice quality of life things. Like, they sort of accepted that it was a pain in the ass because, like, snipers in XCOM can't shoot if they move, unless you have some special perks or something. But they used to have a pistol, so you would move, switch to the pistol for that round, and then switch back to the sniper rifle for the next one. But now it just assumes if you've moved, if you want them to shoot, they'll just automatically shoot with the pistol, which is just a really nice kind of simplification of how they work. And the pistol animation is fucking badass.
Yeah, they use it one-handed.
Yeah, they just said like one-handed draw a pistol and like, yeah, it looks really good.
And it's basically like half the skill tree is pistol stuff. It's like one half is do loads of damage with a sniper rifle and the other half is just be awesome with the pistol.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that in addition to being loads of new stuff and loads of new aliens and things, it's a really smart balance revision of XCOM. Like lots of stuff that's like, just was the better option skill tree wise in the original game is now just mandatory. Like a good example of that is with the new, it's called sharpshooter because it can go either to like pistol, gunslinging or sniping. But they gain squad sight like by default, which was like used to be a choice where you'd make a decision between something that nobody ever took and squad sight, which is the one that allows them to shoot anyone that anyone else on your squad can see.
Which was the best
sniper ability in the game.
What did the standard ability for sniper used to be then?
Headshot, which is now gone. Right. Like headshot was like a guaranteed crit, I think, on a cooldown. But again, it was one of those things where you used it if you had it. And that's an interesting, from a design point of view, one of the interesting things they've changed is they've added a lot. It feels to me that the average accuracy is a lot higher Like, I've had a few moments of like, come on, that was point blank at a giant snake. But broadly speaking, I've had far fewer instances of crazy inaccuracy. And actually I've had, because at the end of every mission, it gives you stats, like your percentage accuracy and how much time you spent in cover and what value of that cover was, which I think is designed to expose to you the actual stuff you can control for when it feels like the RNG is screwing you.
Mm. Have you ever seen like a little breakdown panel of your to hit percentage and what caused it?
I've heard that it's in there, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, so I saw it, and it was right after I switched difficulty, so I thought, oh, cool, on easy, it tells you why you've got only 16% to hit. But I actually haven't seen it since, so I'm not sure what I did.
Don't know how you get that.
I also had a moment earlier where I was trying to level up a soldier, and I'd sort of switched between full screen and windowed mode, and so there's something weird going on with the cursor where 90% of the time it was working, but when clicking on the skill I wanted to choose it, it wouldn't do anything. And I clicked on it, and then it popped up with a window telling me all of the specifics about that skill and saying, oh, it's got a 3-turn cooldown and it's good for this kind of build. And I've never seen that window before, and I don't know how I got it. And I can't tell you how I got it.
The mystery tooltips of XCOM.
I clicked on the icon. It's like a ghost story for tooltips. No one ever saw that window again. No one ever knew what the cooldown would be on the skill.
M. Night Shyamalan's XCOM tutorial.
Yeah, so I'd love to tell you how you get that, but I got it by clicking on the icon to choose a skill, which is not normally just choose the fucking skill, which is what I wanted to do.
But yeah, like one thing I really like about it is it feels like there's more ways to pretty much guarantee that you're going to do damage if you are in the right, if you're willing to take the right resource or risk decisions in order to make it happen. So like the combat protocol for the drone is like 2 guaranteed damage, which is actually surprisingly important because it's not like a sniper rifle which is going to hit someone for 6 damage. It's like, but there are those moments where it's like, you really need to fucking kill the sectoid that's mind controlling somebody. And suddenly having this little robot that will go and just fucking electrocute, son of a bitch, is really, really good. And the old XCOM, it's like a safety net against the old XCOM thing of like, the story would have been better if this alien had been killed now. Yeah. But my guy who was standing right next to him with a shotgun just decided to fire in the air for some reason.
One of the weapon mods will make it so that even if you miss, you do 1 damage, which is amazing. That's just so cool.
There's one of the weapon mods is every hit with that weapon has a small chance to completely kill whatever you shot.
I've got that, and I'm such a believer in it, but it's never happened. One day it'll
they
kill
could just
something.
Lie on that tooltip, and it's still you'd be like, wow, this one's amazing. It's never happened, but it's amazing.
It's 5%, so that's 1 in every 20 shots, and I don't think he's had 20 shots. He's probably had like 18.
There's other things like the way the stealth system works, like where like a lot of missions begin with your squad in stealth, so you then ambush the first part of enemies you come across. And like I find that most of the time, for my reasonably high aim soldiers, the first shot, like the ambush breaking shot, sometimes very often with my sniper has 100% hit chance, which is really good because it means that you're making a, you know, it's the opposite of my thing. You're making a series of interesting decisions. And when you set up that initial ambush, the first decision you make is like, which one of the 4 things I can see dies? Or like, do I have the option I can literally just take out one of the weaker enemies, or I can sufficiently wound one of the scary things so that they're pretty much guaranteed to die in the Overwatch crossfire that then happens.
Yeah.
Like I had one earlier where it was, I thought I was screwed because it was, you know, it was the same mission. It was Sniper Lady and 4 rookies. And the first thing I could see was 2 individual sets of advent units that were next to each other, which were 2 snake people, 2 advent commanders and 2 advent soldiers. So that's like, it's 6-on-5 with advanced stuff, but I managed to kill both of the snake people in the first round of shooting, which was like fucking awesome because that's like the perfect result from that. And that was done by getting all of them on Overwatch except one dude who had to throw a grenade down, which took out one of the soldiers, wounded the snake person. The sniper then kills that snake person. The other snake person runs for it, gets gunned down by everybody else. And it's taken it to 5-on-3 with the 2 scariest things dead before the fight's even started. And so the amount of options to do that for me helps mitigate some of the A, some of the bugs, which will hopefully get fixed, and B, some of the traditional XCOM bullshit.
Yeah, the whole ambush thing is A, really good, and B, does feel like a sort of counter to the most annoying things about the previous XCOM, about, you know, enemies getting a free turn basically to hide from you when you see them. And and it's always, it just means that in every mission, there's going to be 1 great moment because the first time you break, even if it goes wrong, it's still, you know, an amazing moment. But most of the time it goes right because you have so much time to set it up and you can, if it's not a timed mission, you can make sure that just everyone is in line of fire, everyone's on Overwatch. And as soon as they react to you shooting them, they're going to get shot a lot more.
Yeah. It's also worth pointing out how much the beginning of that game is like Mass Effect 2. Like, there's like a 3 or 4 plot beats from the beginning of that game that are all in Mass Effect 2. But that I can't really say without spoiling. But it just occurred to me that this is the Mass Effect 2 of isometric games where all your friends die.
It's the Mass Effect 2 of the XCOM series. Yeah. It's the second one.
Well, it's the second one. There's a good reveal of a spaceship. There's a surgery bit. There's a death and rebirth sequence. Everything's gone to shit. Yeah, it's got loads of the same things. Honest, I'm not mad.
You're just seeing Mass Effect 2 in everything.
Yeah, I do, though. It's got a cool... Actually, also, yeah, that the soundtrack's also fucking amazing. I'd also say that for it. Sounds great.
So we do the questions that come from the questions.
That's where they come from.
Let's do them from there. Travis writes, hello. I've set a challenge for myself, designing and building a game inside 48 hours of work. The people of CNC Discord channel have been helping, in quote marks. Because to this, I need to know the following. If there were an army of penguins armed with spears and swords, what would their cavalry ride? Thanks, Travis. I think Travis designed the game prototype we played where you sort of build your own traps out of kind of circuit bits and sort of individual components.
Yeah, like that was very cool.
Motion sensors.
Very, very cool.
Yeah, it was really
he's good. Got a, I think he links a YouTube video, which we'll put in the show notes.
Yes.
Which shows his progress in this game, which on the face of it looks like a bit like Total War, as though it was played by giant pills. but I haven't dug very far into the videos yet. I assume those pills will at one time be penguins and some of the other pills will be penguins riding ...
I see them as more of like a chariot species.
Yeah.
Like, I don't...
They're more a motorized transport, I think, if you get far enough down the tech tree.
Yeah, but in the shorter term, like, because they're quite squat creatures, I can't imagine them, like, actually, like, saddling up on like, anything else. But, you know, a little, maybe a chariot pulled by... Arctic foxes.
Yeah, could be.
Walruses.
Yeah, sea lions.
Either ride the walrus or have the walrus pull the chariot, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd quite like to see a Mad Max-style kind of jalopy with a penguin.
Or maybe I would like to see penguins ride unicycles.
Well, implement all of those ideas, please.
Maybe Travis. like a little battle cabin on top of a polar bear. Like, you know, like the Oliphants in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a couple of penguins up there in a little wooden hut. Yeah. That. Do that. Just do that. Easy.
Problem solved. Ryan writes, greetings, fellow cave explorers and ancient defenders. I started listening to the CNC back in October, and I'm hooked. I found that my opinions on what makes games great and what makes games stuck closely match your own. I've been looking forward to XCOM 2, but I was resisting the urge to pre-order. Then I read Tom Senior's review of the game and realized that the quote I'd been seeing on the game Steam banner, "We'll play this game forever," was from his review. I yelled at my monitor, "I know that guy!" 30 seconds later, pre-order complete. My question, what are some specific video game reviews that heavily influence you to try a game you now love? Why do you think they influence you as heavily as they did? Please provide links to reviews in the show notes if they can be found online. Keep up the polity quadcasting.
The polity quadcasting.
I think you know what I meant. Cheers, Ryan Kincaid.
You got an example, Chris?
I do, actually. And awkwardly, because I don't...
It's your own review.
No, it's one of yours.
That's oh, really?
Yeah. It was your Bioshock review, because that was before I was a games journalist, I think. But I think I probably would have played that game anyway. But... like, I hadn't actually been a massive fan of System Shock or anything like that, so the games have occupied the space in my mind where this is for people who like System Shock 2, which I now appreciate more than I did at the time. But yeah, no, that was a good review, and it made me try a game that I went on to really, really care about. So,
thanks.
Yeah, good work, Tom.
I think I bought and played Quarantine on the basis of a legendary game reviewer, Jim McCauley's review of it in probably PC Format magazine.
I remember Quarantine, the taxi you're driving on.
Yeah, yeah. They later recanted that score and said that anybody who bought the game was an idiot, unfortunately.
Wow, but real bait on switch on the readership.
But I did enjoy that game, and it's one of the reasons I can't drive, because it trained me to want to kill things while I was sitting in a car.
I'm always... greatly entertained by, but ultimately uninfluenced by, Tim Stone's reviews, because he can write incredibly engagingly, excitingly about games that I will never play, i.e. hardcore flight sims and really, hardcore again, historical war games. And he can, like, because he totally gets those games. He can like bring the pleasure of playing them to the surface and make you understand why they're cool without actually giving me the desire to really play them, because I feel like I've had the fun now.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I enjoy this podcast, is because everybody on it has very different tastes myself. And I'm never going to play Worm Online. quite like the fact that Graham has. That's good.
Mm.
Yeah.
Stuff. I love, I recently watched a video by Richard Cobbett, who used to do the crapshoot column for RPS. Oh, no, hang on.
PC Gamer.
I think sorry.
You're fine.
Yes, PC Gamer. And now does his own videos of his own back called Shooting Crap, I think.
Really?
And he an amazing game. I can't remember. What's the name of the game? Shit. Maybe you guys remember the video recently tweeted. I'll find it. Anyway, it's obviously an appalling, appalling piece of shit. And Rich manages to make it absolutely a pleasure to watch somehow. So those are the kind of games, those are the kind of reviews I cherish more, is somewhere either a divergent and interesting opinion from my own, or one which explains a game to me that I'll never otherwise develop an opinion on, because it's so far from my wheelhouse.
Games journalism, pretty cool. So are all the people who do it. Charlie Robinson writes, "Hi, creators. Love the Witness chat." Oh, good, because you got more of it this week. I'm a trained philosopher and always enjoy a game that has philosophical pretensions, whether it's genuinely good philosophy or complete wishy-washy box COD philosophy. Do you have any good examples of games that fail or succeed in this sense? Best wishes, Charlie.
I like the idea of I know a trained philosopher is a real thing. But
Tom's a trained philosopher.
Yeah, well, for sure, but it's just...
Educated.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, feral, but educated.
I didn't go to boot camp.
I like to imagine the emergency where that's something you need to declare.
Let me through, I'm a trained philosopher. Yeah.
The pilot doesn't think the plane is real anymore. Shake him out of it.
Yeah, there's... I was thinking about this. There's a few games that I think are pretty good. The Swapper is pretty interesting. In fact, quite a lot of games touch on the idea of what is consciousness, because a lot of games involve AI, and there is obviously a debate about, you know, AI becoming conscious. And
in The Swapper, you have a gun that fires your consciousness. Like, yeah. You make clones, and then you shoot your consciousness into them. The question of, like, oh, which is the real you? Oh, it's okay, the real you is in the gun, and I just fire the gun at them.
Yes, if only Descartes has come to that. Therefore, I'm probably a gun. I don't know. That's kind of cool for the writing that comes around it. It's obviously draped around what is essentially a puzzle game, so it feels always a slightly bit forced, but I do quite like it. The Fall, which I talked about in the podcast a while ago, is also interesting in that you play like an emergency life support AI of a suit which contains either a dead or a dying human being who has fallen to a planet in some catastrophe or another, and you then negotiate with the AIs that are on that planet, it seems to be like a robot AI recycling planet, which does not bode well for you, because obviously you are a robot AI, and you have to kind of debate with them about the fact that you have an intelligence inside you, potentially, that could be salvaged. But there are other things going on there. It's not mechanically a very satisfying game to play. It takes the form of a side-scrolling platformer for the most part, with some puzzle elements. I think that stuff is janky, but the writing in it was really interesting. I never finished it because I'm a twat. But also, finally, let me wank on a bit more about Dark Souls, which is obviously one of the greatest meditations on divine predestination that you'll get in video games.
Was that the full wank? Is the wank included?
I think there's been so much wank on this podcast. There
are hundreds of hours of video wank on this topic.
I have really pretty wanked on this.
I was going to mention Soma, which I think we talked about the philosophical side of it when we talked about it. But that is a game where you're in an underwater base, video games. And it examines the idea of like robots that believe they're real, or transporting a consciousness into a digital entity of some kind, like be it a software program or an actual robot. And the thing that's cool about it, I mean, generally it's just pretty smart about that stuff. It doesn't sort of, I think the thing I like about it is they didn't go into it with like, oh, we believe A, So here's how we're going to make B look stupid. Or here's how we're going to explain to you through the plot that B is ultimately false. It feels very even-handed. There are factions in it who believe an extreme of one side of it. So the debate being, if you transfer your consciousness into a piece of software or a robotic entity, is that really you in there, or have you just sort of made a software program? And if, let's say, your physical form is going to die, is that a adequate form of resurrection, or is that just a completely empty gesture? And in the game, there are factions who believe one extreme or the other of that, and those go a bit far to the point where, you know, they believe in it so much they do completely crazy things.
Some person standing in the undersea hellscape base full of screaming automatons going, this has gone a bit far.
Down with this sort of thing.
Yeah. But the game itself doesn't sort of say, these guys are right and those guys are right. It gives a pretty... They give compelling arguments for both sides, which is something that most things that touch on philosophy don't. And also, as a game, the other thing it does well as a game examination of a philosophical subject is it just puts you into it right from the start. I'm trying not to spoil anything about it, but you very quickly have a very personal understanding of this topic. That is disorienting in a way. It like, happens so suddenly and so immediately and so conclusively. It's not a game where you wonder, am I really human?
Right.
That's revealed pretty early on. And that is just sort of like, doesn't necessarily make a specific kind of point about it. It just makes you immersed in it in a way that you wouldn't be if you're just listening to a lecturer telling you about this problem.
I really like the Talos principle as well, which is directly about philosophy, really. I mean, there's no, it's not pulling any punches. And what's interesting about that, rather than not siding with anybody, it allows you to take any position and then uses other pre-existing philosophical arguments to deconstruct it horribly. And so you can never be right in that game in any conversation, which is slightly frustrating, but also interesting.
It's a game about conversations you had at 4 a.m. at uni.
Yeah.
Where you also while solving a puzzle with lasers.
Yes. Yeah.
You need to get back into your uni flat. You need to like redirect a giant ball. The Talos principle.
I think, I don't know if I got stuck on the game. I stopped playing at some point, and I think it was because of the puzzles, but I was enjoying it in general.
It's good.
These questions just reminded me of something I wanted to talk about if we have time. But Joshua writes, dear Gearbox and Wrench, in an interesting role reversal, I'm helping my psychologist quit smoking. One of the techniques that really helps is one that was recommended to me via Jane McGonigal's Super Better book. Play a pattern matching game like Bejeweled or Tetris for 5 minutes is enough to control the mind's eye. These games are both simple and require quite a bit of concentration. One can become fully enveloped in them for a short time, thus evicting the thoughts of smoking from one's brain. This has been a great boon to my psychologist, although I hope he does not develop a Tetris addiction. And the book mentions that soldiers playing games after they have suffered traumatic experiences are far less likely to develop PTSD. Which leads to the question, are there any games you feel would aid people who either need or give psychological help, and why? Bonus question, if you were to design a game for such a purpose, what would it look like? Kind greetings, Joshua Vorderman. I have not actually suffered anything serious enough for this to be really quite what he's talking about, but anytime I'm ill and in like constant pain, I always play games just to the exclusion of all else, basically. And I remember I had a really bad stomach bug around the time Dragon Age Inquisition came out, and that just got me through it so well, because it's immersive, you know, as a good game is, but also just has so many things going on, just so many, like, you know, loot systems and crafting and upgrades and things that you can just binge on it completely and let it just occupy all of your brain. And stuff like, there's loads of things about when you're ill, things that are so much worse if you're just in a room doing nothing, like a sense of nausea in particular. If there's nothing going on, nausea seems to just sort of crop up when it otherwise wouldn't. And if you can just focus on something and let your mind be busy with it, that seems to solve it. And yeah, addictive games. Actually, one thing I noticed, another time I was ill, I was playing Wolfenstein, The New Order. And
right, very therapeutic.
That has action sequences and stealth sequences, or bits that you can do as stealth or action, but I always did them as stealth. And I found that the stealth sections were much better at taking my mind off things, because during a stealth section, you're just There's no kind of downtime. You're always tense. You're always focusing really intently on what's going to happen next. And so, yeah, it just fills up your brain with all of that. You're just always thinking about, you know, you can spend 2 minutes creeping up on the same group of enemies without anything actually happening. And all of that time, nothing's happening, but you're just constantly thinking about it. You have to be just completely focused on what's going on.
Hmm.
Did you guys have any thoughts for games you feel would aid people who either need or give psychological help?
Well, a while ago, I did an article for Edge magazine, which I talked to various people involved in wargaming and the opposite of wargaming, which is therapeutic games about war. And it's interesting that the example given there is like the opposite. It's like an antithesis of war in order to cure PTSD, because the person I was speaking to, whose name I've forgotten, unfortunately, was advocating games which actually recreate the traumatic situation in some way as a part of the therapy. Obviously, it's not just that. You're not just triggering somebody's trauma and then leaving them. you are in some way analyzing it and talking about it as well. So, there you go. That's as much insight as I have into it, I'm afraid.
Hmm. Yeah, it feels like games, like, my suggestions were just about the most shallow thing that games do, which is be addictive and just take up.
Well, distraction. I mean, that's as much as that accounts for the distraction from the desire to smoke, right? No, it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Julius Soitz. Hi there. Not long ago, you answered the question, what was your best kill in a video game? Let's keep the theme going and celebrate your best escape scenes. I'm mostly asking this so I can tell my own story, to be honest. Many years ago, I was playing Halo Collector's Edition on the internet. I was fighting with an enemy at the edge of a large open map. We had both lost our shields, but I ran out of ammo and had to reload my pistol. I instantly knew that I would be killed before the reloading animation finished, and there was no cover around either. However, there was a body of a dead teammate lying next to me. His weapon beside him. It was a shit weapon, but picking it up would be slightly faster than reloading. It was a desperate move, but with no better option available, I stepped to the side to pick up his weapon and drove away in a warthog. Wait, what? I was really perplexed, but I managed to solve the mystery of what happened there. There were a couple of facts that worked together in tandem. Fact 1, Halo Collector's Edition has a serious problem with team killing. A teammate of mine tried to run me over with his warthog, a type of jeep, but I perfectly sidestepped him when I tried to pick up the weapon. I would not have been able to enter the vehicle driven by an enemy. Fact 2, Halo CE had an audio bug where vehicles were inaudible when they were behind you. That meant I was completely unaware of it until it passed me. Fact 3, usually picking up items and interacting vehicles are different buttons, but I had bound it to the same key instead. And I pressed that key at the exact time when the passenger seat was right next to me. Fact 4, entering vehicles happens to override picking up items. And this is how I gloriously got away from my dumbfounded opponent. I wish I could have seen the look on his face. It was the greatest extraction operation I've ever witnessed. That is amazing.
Yeah, I can't top that at all, I'm afraid.
I always talk about these, like, best evers, because I can always only ever think of, like, most recently.
Mm.
I did have a good one playing Rainbow Six.
Well, your XCOM story is pretty good for extracting.
Yeah, that's an extraction story.
What was your Rainbow Six story? Let's talk about Rainbow Six. I love Rainbow Six.
Let's bring this back to Siege, if we possibly can.
Game of the Year 2015 and 2016.
Rainbow Six Siege. Well, you know how there's, like, hostage extraction in that game, but no one ever actually extracts the hostage. People just kill each other, and then...
yeah, mostly.
Yeah, except those moments where one of the attackers accidentally shoots the hostage, and then you get to watch the end of round replay from his perspective, which is just, like, the slow-mo you fucked it, Cam. As he, like, rounds a corner and sees a human shape, and you see he's bringing his gun up, and then bang, and then the hostage...
You say he, but you mean me. It's not Marsh. Often, sadly, yes.
Yeah, it's a unique and very candid account of the exact moment when he knew he'd fucked up. but anyway, having a game, I think I might have already been dead at this point, but I'll sort of tell it from a team perspective. I might be conflating two different rounds. And it's one of those really horrible close-range knife fights with, like, maybe three people left on each team around the hostage room. You know, defenders lying down, just trying to, like, get pot shots into people's feet underneath doors. All the walls that can be blown out have been blown out. We're out of breach charges, whatever. Smoke and shit everywhere. And there's sort of, you know, snipey firefight, people trying to peek but not wanting to get headshotted and that kind of thing. It's all very kind of edgy. And in the midst of this, another smoke grenade goes off. I think it was a defender's smoke grenade. If they can get them, I don't know if they can. I don't think they can, actually, so maybe it was in tech. I don't know who threw it.
Might have been smoke grenade, which isn't real smoke, but poison smoke.
It wasn't smoke grenade because it didn't kill anyone. Wasn't killing the hostage.
No, I think only attackers have.
Yeah. Smoke grenade goes off, and people still peeking, and then at some point, my friend realizes the objective of this is just to take the hostage, isn't it? So just walks into the room, like, not shooting at anybody, takes the hostage's hand and just leaves. And the smoke clears, and everyone's still sniping and peeking, and everyone's sort of forgotten what the purpose of the game is. As, you know, hand in hand, my friend and the hostage just escape down the stairs, run away to freedom, and the round ends, like, with baffled defenders remembering what it is they were there to do.
What a game.
Game
of the year.
It's actually the only time I've ever seen a round win with a proper hostage extraction, actually.
Not often, but reasonably frequently. Have you played the new boat map?
I have played with the new operators. The bear trap is fucking terrifying.
It's great. I love seeing that as the last round kill.
Yeah.
What is the name of the person who has the bear trap?
Frost.
Frost.
Okay. I thought it was going to be bear.
She's
smoky.
They're ice themed because they're from Canada, which is basically an iceberg.
Ice, yeah.
Is this an update or?
Yeah. It's a free, in inverted commas, DLC pack, which offers you the chance to buy stuff. But to their credit, they do offer
To their credit, the maps and the characters are free. So it's just
But if you bought a season pass, you do get advance access to them.
Yeah.
So you can pay to get them.
Huh. But it's not the kind of community dividing map pack thing other shooters have done. But yeah, I love that game's incredibly earnest attempt to kind of present Canada as a kind of incredibly edgy special forces.
It is on the edge of North America.
And maybe that's, maybe that's patronizing of me to assume that Canada must always be funny.
But I love Canadians. They're great.
No, that's why my sister lives in Canada.
Yeah, it's a good place.
Yeah, it's a great place. But there's something, I think maybe they'll have this tone for everything, and it's because they've never in any other context singled out one region. Like, the game comes with, German special forces, French special forces, English, American.
The Russians are easily the most terrifying.
And the Russians are terrifying, yeah. Because, you've got, a drone that electrocutes people. I've got a nail bomb.
I'm taking this more seriously than you.
There's some themes to the ones, the Russians are just there to kill people. The British are all, kind of anti-technology. Like, that's their kind of whole thing.
They all wear gas masks.
Edge. They all wear gas masks. It's like, you've got a breach in charge. I've got a hammer.
And my beauties.
Yeah. And I've cooked this gas grenade myself, and I'm not allowed to tell you what's in it, even though that's vastly unprofessional for a couple of months. The British one is sort of homebrew mania. I made this in my shed and now I'm going to kill some people.
And the Germans are all kind of smart casual. Going to the discotheque.
I'm wearing my Converse.
I'm wearing Converse. I'm wearing jeans.
In my flipper screens, he's just a smoke.
For some reason.
But they've never put this sort of singular focus on it, like a single faction, until they've done the Canada map and the Canada operatives all in one thing. And it's called Black Ice.
Yeah. Sort of a light ice lock boat. Which is obviously in ice. One of them's called Frost. The other one's called Buck because he fires a shotgun. But also, a buck is the name of a male moose, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which
Canada's fiercest animal.
Canes love.
Yeah. Buck's really fun, though, because he's the only attacker who gets a shotgun, I think.
Maybe.
Because and that's his whole thing is he can breach with it. It's he's the only attacker that, other than Ash, that can breach ceilings. So there you go. Fact.
I feel like there was a real switcheroo in the development of this game where it went from being terrorists and counter-terrorists to attackers and defenders.
Yeah.
I can't even see how you'd make that switch because it's so fundamental.
I think somebody sent in a correction to my pointing out that this wasn't canon, the canon didn't make sense to say that they're all just war games. They're not real, which doesn't really explain why people explode in blood and die in front of you, fair play.
Interesting.
One of the maps, that makes sense. One of them is clearly a training facility, but the rest of them is this is someone's house.
Yeah. They didn't just landlock a boat for the purposes of a training exercise. Landlock? Ice lock? Whatever. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, ice is a type of land. It's a subset of the land genre.
It's in the fringe between ice and sea. Land and sea.
Water so Canadian, it's become land.
Doesn't make any sense. But yeah, one of them's a lady with a bear trap, and she's terrifying. Because the bear trap doesn't show up as electronics, which, again, is a problem for IQ, the shittest character in the
MCU. Fair enough, bear traps aren't electronic. At least not that kind. Elliot Kingston asks, do you think the Vive will get any other type of controllers like for your feet, and what games would you make to use them?
I love the idea of having to grip like normal Vive controllers in your toes. I just don't know why that's so good. I don't know, it's such a good image.
Really engaging with the game, lying sort of like half on your ass, half on your back, your arms and legs
just
in the air.
Waggling
like a baby.
Ah, games.
So that's
a game. I'm a real gamer.
It's like, it's the gamer baby writ large. What would a foot controller look like? It's
gamer
like,
shoes.
You can't really grip anything with your feet. At least I personally can't. And nothing non-trivial, anyway. So it'd have to be, like, strapped to your foot. But then if you wanted any kind of actual intentional control, other than just the position of your foot, you would need to have some kind of toe buttons. maybe a toe trackpad.
I don't know, the position of your foot is particularly important in any game, apart from ones where your foot speed indicates you're running, those kind of weird trackpad things, which give you some kind of weird...
Looks like a baby walker.
Yeah, like a waist anchoring thing, and then a big
If you didn't have that, but you had foot controllers, you could do the room-size VR thing and have the position of your feet actually be important. Like, they could be treacherous ground and safe ground, and you have to pick your way across.
Be VR shoes at that point, right? Like,
yeah. The shoes is the only way to do it. Because it's like, it's, you know.
I think maybe there's a weird thing where anything you end up having to do with your feet kind of comes across as, like, either infantile or kind of animalistic. Because, like...
We don't use them that often.
We don't use them that often. And, like, the things we associate with using your feet in that way is kind of, like... Idiots. So proud of the fact that we can walk.
Yeah.
Pedals are the obvious other answer to this, though.
Oh, yeah. I suppose so.
Because they exist.
Yeah. We already have foot controllers for our cars in the real world. And, in fact, we have mimicked those for games as well.
Cars and organs.
I have something I want to talk about quickly. Writing a question into the podcast.
Please do. Yeah.
I'm going to answer my own question.
Go on.
Which is, have you seen Atlas Shrugged?
No, I haven't, Tom. Maybe somebody else in this podcast has.
I have.
Wow.
So Atlas Shrugged is the book by Ayn Rand, which strongly inspired the plot of Bioshock, at least. And I knew this, and I knew that Ayn Rand's philosophy was something called objectivism, which Bioshock... kind of takes apart, and what I didn't realize was how close the plot of Bioshock is to the plot of Atlas Shrugged.
Right,
so Atlas Shrugged is now a movie, a three-part movie, made, I think, by some kind of conservative think tank or funding group, because I don't think it's been very successful, but they made all three of them, and every single movie, they had to find an entirely new cast. One's in it twice. Every new movie, they carry on directly from each other. They pick up where the last one finished off, but they have to replace every single cast.
Surely they should realize that the movie's lack of success is an indicator of the philosophy itself.
Because those individual actors all have the right to make a selfish decision to preserve their own career, which is to back out of the project midway through.
I see. Yeah.
It's an amazing thing that this movie about the virtue of capitalism, about how much the fact that how much money you make in what you do proves its value and like finally determines whether what you did was good or not, was itself a commercial failure. But it was fascinating because it's almost like a companion piece to Bioshock, because I didn't realize that the plot of Atlas Shrugged is it's on Netflix, by the way. Parts 1 and 2 are on Netflix, part 3 is not. And the plot of Atlas Shrugged is, it's not just like about individualism and people earning their own way and resisting government regulation and stuff. It's actually about a eccentric genius who just sort of decides to leave society and then starts poaching all the best and brightest people to take to his own little utopia, which is called Atlantis. It's not actually a city under the sea, but it's named after one. And it's all of the series takes place basically in the world that those people left. So it's not about the cool utopia that they all go to, although possibly dystopia. It's about the world that's left behind and how it all falls apart. And I watched it because in the trailer, it had a cool futuristic train. And I would watch basically anything with a cool train in it. But then I kept watching it and watched all three movies because it's actually like totally fascinating to watch a movie that's made with just a totally different set of ideals. Not totally is the wrong word. Radically different set of ideals, because the like the Hollywood set of ideals are so familiar to us and so cliched that it's not even a question. It's just, of course, every movie will have the message that love wins out overall, and that helping people is good, and that the usual Hollywood cliches. And it's quite an interesting, like, cultural artifact to watch a movie made by people who, like, sincerely believe that charity is not only, like, unnecessary, but actually evil. So they will have scenes. It's so familiar. Like, it's so similar to cheesy, sort of crappy Hollywood movies that lazily demonize people by having them be fat and ugly and have horrible names and just be randomly jerks to people around them. They'll do all that, and then in the middle of that speech, that person will suddenly just casually mention that they're also giving money to help the needy. And that's just part and parcel of the way they're demonized. Like, oh, can you believe that motherfucker? He's giving money to charity. What a jerk. And that's just like part of the movie's value set. Whenever anyone is being a fucking asshole, they'll be talking about helping the needy. And it has this bizarre, like, in order to sort of extol its philosophy, obviously it's the book, I think, is just a mouthpiece for her to have certain characters just say her philosophy out loud. And the movie is very much that. And people just stop and give a very long speech. Like, there are just characters who are on the good side. And the good side is the one where, of being utterly selfish and making as much money as possible. The main, one of the two main characters, who is kind of the love interest from the main character, just outright says that he's only interested in profit. That is his ultimate goal in life, is just to make as much money as possible. And that's like celebrated as a hero. One of the other like sort of hero characters is an oil baron.
And wow.
It's like at the end of one of the first movie, the heroine says, his name is, Elliot Wyatt or something. I think Elliot Wyatt. And she says, I'm so glad there are still people like Elliot Wyatt in the world, the oil baron. And it ends, the first movie ends.
Did she actually explain who he is? Elliot Wyatt, the oil baron?
No, sorry.
Oh, okay. Right.
But like, he's done nothing except just profiteer, basically. And also, he and also her love interest both brag about overcharging her for their services, saying, her love interest says, I hope you don't mind that I'm completely fleecing you in this price just to take advantage of the fact that you're in a spot of need. And she says, no, I wouldn't expect anything less. And then they make out.
Wow, hot.
And then the first movie, this is going to be
50 Shades of Train.
50 Shades of Green, perhaps.
Nice. Oh, yeah.
There is... I'm going to spoil everything. But the first movie ends with her... She's been emotionless throughout, and she actually says at the start that she has no emotions, and her brother mocks her for it. But then it ends with her screaming at the skies, no! And it's not because someone died. It's because Wyatt set fire to his oil fields, and all the precious oil is burning up, and he's fucked off. And then it has just... series, it gets more amazing as it goes on, the trilogy. I watched all three movies in rapt attention and
raptured attention.
They're all of the people they poach. This guy John Galt is poaching all of these people from society, and they're the best and the brightest, and they're all the people who are giving more than they're receiving. Like, they're the people who are really holding society together, but then government is intruding on their business and saying, one of the, like, horror moments in the first movie is they pass legislation that means no one person can run more than one corporation. And they're just like, oh my God, this is horrible. And now I've got to sign away all my seven companies so I can only keep the one company, instead of just restructuring that one company to do the other seven businesses. So the, like, that's the sort of business side of it. And then towards the end, John Galt is recruiting all these people, and it's just sort of the underlying assumption of it all is they're the real people who make things happen in the world. And if you take those out of society, society collapses. That's why it's like a dystopia where the whole world is collapsing. But it's just because John Galt is taking those people away to his own little Atlantis utopia. And they're all CEOs. They're all white CEOs. I think one is Hispanic. Everyone else is a white CEO. And they're like, one of them is the oil baron. And they take him to a utopia where John Galt's thing is that he invented this engine that can run on air, basically, and just generate infinite electricity for free, completely clean, with no downside. why does he recruit the Oil Baron? What does the Oil Baron do when he gets there?
Oh, shit, yeah.
And they,
wow, what a plot hole.
There's no, like, no manual laborers are recruited in any way. Everyone is just the head of a massive multi-million dollar corporation. And it's just assumed those are the people who really get things done. If you just had, if only we could just have like, I think there's only about 20 of them. Just take about 20 people and put them in a rural paradise and be like, well, that's our society. This is utopia now.
It's the fantasy of the rapture, but for twats.
The twapture.
It has a properly amazing ending where, the main character, Dagny Taggart, she clearly is an objectivist, but she kind of needs some persuading that the whole world has to be abandoned and she needs to go to this utopia and just hang out with her rich friends. she's hesitant about that. She thinks she should fight the fight and, you know, try and make the world good. And then she's convinced that no, that is worthless. And then she has to break into a facility to rescue John Galt. And, she has a science pistol and she goes up to the first guard and, points the gun at him and then says, like, okay, you have a choice. Either you can move out of my way or you can let me in. And his response to this is clearly either Ayn Rand or maybe the person who adapted this for film, their opinion of what non-CEOs are in the world, what regular people are. He says, I can't let you in. And then she says, well, you know, you've got to choose between I'm going to kill you or you can let me in. He says, but I'm just an average person. I'm not allowed to make decisions. I can't choose. And then she tries to persuade him again to make a choice, and he just repeats that he's like an average person. Average people can't make decisions, so she just kills him.
Oh, okay.
Right. And then she rescues John Galt, and they fly off on a helicopter, and she says to John Galt, you are my forever. And then they see that all the lights are shutting down in the cities because all power is like the whole world's gone to shit because they don't have these CEOs. And she says, this is the end. And he says, no, it's the beginning. And then it says, the end, which is corny enough, and then a little title comes up below the end saying, no, it's the beginning. That is how the trilogy ends. It's amazing.
Oh, God.
Thoroughly recommend it.
I will warn you, though, that being drawn in by a cool train is how libertarian capitalism starts.
But
it's a slippery slope.
The train isn't even that cool, actually. It only comes up right at the end. It's just it's a largish train. You know.
Oh, shit.
It runs on some good rails. It doesn't have the magic engine or anything.
You should watch Snowpiercer.
You should watch Snowpiercer.
I have watched that. That's
we watched that
cool at train.
Tom's house, didn't we?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We watched it together. I'm sorry. Never mind.
That's a good dystopian film with a
That's
cool
a good
train.
Class system on rails.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's another anti-Randian kind of thing.
That is so much as simplistic and absurd as it is, that is so much more nuanced and complex and understanding of human nature than this.
If you like making fun of Ayn Rand, you should completely read Mallory Ortberg's rewritings.
Oh, yes.
Randian rewritings of popular fiction on the toast. She recently
did
Firefly.
I read her Firefly one.
It's
fucking fantastic.
Great. It's, yeah. It, better read it, because I'm not funny enough to remember to paraphrase it.
Is that it for questions, Tom?
Yep, that's it.
That's it for questions. No, that's more time for questions.
Rand from Rand.
from Rand. If you'd like to send us more questions, you can do so by sending them to questions@crateandcrowbar.com, or you can tweet them at crateandcrowbar.
That's the easy bit, sure.
That's what it's called.
I'm sorry. Well, you know, it's late. I've been ill all week, and more excuses. Or you can go to our forums at creatingcrowbar.com/forum. You can go to our Discord channel, the link for which is on creatingcrowbar.com. Or you can tweet at us individually. I am Marsh Davis on the Twitters. Who are you, Tom?
At Pentadact, PENTADACT.
And I am C. Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
That there we
are. I was taking a drink at the time you did that, so I couldn't join in.
That's too quick.
Too fast.